I had to wait in line for coffee this morning.
I'm so sorry. That must have been incredibly brave of you.
It was 6 minutes. Six! I aged. I reflected. I almost became a different person.
Yeah, like at 4 minutes, you start thinking about your childhood. Minute six, you're like, maybe I should change my life.
Exactly. And that's when it hit me. We are no longer a people who wait. We don't stand in lines. We don't sit with uncertainty. We don't just exist in the gap between wanting something and getting it. We have smartphones now, damn it.
No, that's right. We optimize it, eliminate it. If there's friction, we assume something is broken.
Right. I can order a phone charger at breakfast, and it shows up before I've even fully admitted I lost the last one. I can summon food, a ride, a person, anything instantly. And if a text bubble appears and then disappears, I start to think, did I piss them off? What's happening?
You could just be like me and ignore all the text messages because of your crippling anxiety.
Well, the point is, we don't wait anymore. We track. We monitor. We expect constant confirmation that the world is responding to us.
Which is why today is going to be a challenge. Not that we're going to make you wait, but if you try to imagine what waiting was like in the 1850s, it's going to feel like psychological warfare.
Truly. Because picture this. You leave Ohio, your comfy house, for California during the gold rush, 3,000 miles away. You say goodbye to your family. That might be the last time you ever see them.
And the only way to communicate with them is this old-fashioned thing called a letter.
An honest-to-Jeebus letter. Ink. A quill pen and a piece of paper that may or may not actually serve as your envelope also. A letter that will take 3 to 6 months to arrive, if it arrives at all. No tracking, no updates, no out for delivery. You write it, hand it off, and then it vanishes into the void.
And that silence isn't alarming, it's just normal. People expected that.
And that's the part that's hard to wrap your head around. Not the distance, not even the danger, just waiting. Living your entire life inside that kind of uncertainty. That's just what you did.
Meanwhile, I'm watching a tiny car icon on an app and getting mad when it turns the wrong way to not bring our tacos here fast enough.
That is the modern outrage. Now, here's the big question of the episode. What does it feel like to wait for a letter?
I mean, I feel like I need to recalibrate my brain to even imagine it. Like, not waiting for a text, a letter. I wrote a missionary, so I know what that was like. But that was, you know, it was a week back and forth to Melbourne, Australia. And back then, 6 months waiting to hear from your beloved? I don't think so.
In the modern era, we occasionally wait for an email. But that's different. We're not waiting a few days. We're talking weeks. Months. You moved to California in 1850. The gold rush is taking you 3,000 miles from your lovely family in Ohio. Your mother doesn't know if you're alive. You don't know if your father's health has improved. Did the dreaded consumption finally get him? You left a wife behind. You left children. You might have one that you've never seen yet. And a letter from home takes anywhere from 3 to 6 months to reach you again, if it reaches you at all.
This is genuinely distressing to sit with. I'm going to work on my box breathing.
It is distressing. And that's the emotional entry point for today's episode, because the story we're going to tell about the Pony Express, about Mormon freighting and mail carrying, the YX Company, Howard Egan, Porter Rockwell, it's not a logistics story. It's a story about human beings desperate to stay connected across an almost incomprehensible distance.
And if you think this title, The Mail, is boring, if you think this is a boring subject, well, you're kind of dumb. Because understanding how these things work is essential to understanding why people make choices the way that they do, how they're getting information, how they're distributing information. And it's also a story with enormous political stakes. Like, this isn't just about letters to your mom. Control of the mail in the 1850s is control of information. And we're talking economic power here.
Exactly. As friend of the podcast Newman helpfully explained.
You remember this. When you control the mail, you control information.
Exactly. And the Mormons understood that better than almost anybody.
Okay, so let's set the scene, because I think listeners need to really understand what communication looked like in this country before any of this happened, because it's genuinely wild. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
So let's go back to 1848. You have an already enormous country, and the U.S. has just signed the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which hands over the entire American Southwest, including what will become Utah, Nevada, California, New Mexico, Arizona. Uncle Sam's just kind of let himself go in the haunches down there.
And simultaneously, gold is discovered at Sutter's Mill 9 days after that treaty is signed.
9 days. And you will probably remember, Mormon battalion members were actually there for that discovery. There's a nice little connection in that.
The Mormons are always in the room, making it about them.
So suddenly, you've got this massive tidal wave of immigration heading west. Tens of thousands of people. And this newish country still doesn't have much of an infrastructure to connect them to the rest of the nation. The Eastern Telegraph Line, which Samuel Morse had demonstrated just a few years earlier, was barely reaching the Midwest. There's no railroad west of Missouri, and the mail? The official U.S. mail?
It went by ship around Cape Horn.
Around Cape Horn. That takes 4 to 8 months. Or you could take the Isthmus route through Panama, which is faster, maybe 6 weeks, but dangerous and expensive. Just ignore that. I'm sure it has no connection to these rampant malaria cases all around us. Or you could just go overland, which is grueling and seasonal and largely dependent on whoever managed to win a government mail contract that year.
Those contracts were a whole drama unto themselves.
Oh, they absolutely were. Here's the landscape in the early 1850s. The U.S. Post Office Department is handing out contracts for mail delivery on various routes. These contracts are worth big bucks. The route between Independence, Missouri and Salt Lake City, route number 8911 for you route wonks, is a perfect example of this dysfunction. You've got Samuel Woodson, a Missourian, who won the bid for a 30-day service in 1850. 30 days! I mean, that's already slow. And Woodson can't even deliver on that time frame.
And if you don't understand that now by listening to this podcast that the terrain is absolutely brutal, you have to understand that Fort Laramie to Salt Lake City in winter is, I mean, those of us who know Utah and Wyoming know what that means. If you have to drive there now, the road shuts down. It's a hard way to pass.
You're driving on I-15 here in Salt Lake and you see on the sign, I-80 to Laramie is closed at the border. It's barely snowing here. It's brutal.
When it's just a wind warning and they topple all these semis. It looked like a bunch of cockroaches, like it tipped over. It's crazy.
Yeah, so Woodson will subcontract the hard winter section to Faramore's Little, who just happens to be Brigham Young's nephew. And the mail is still late. Woodson will lose that contract in 1854. Then in walks W.M.F. McGraw, this Maryland businessman who wins the bid. And McGraw is interesting because he is going to become a major villain in our story.
Oh, McGraw, don't worry. I'm primed to already hate this guy because when I hear McGraw, it reminds me of the memory seared into my brain of my high school textbooks.
Yeah, a McGraw-Hill joke is exactly the first thing I thought of when I saw this episode. And this podcast is brought to you by Anne Shirley Kindred Spirits. Bad textbook jokes. All right, we will absolutely get to McGraw, but now, just know that by 1856, Salt Lake residents are so fed up with this crappy mail service, they hold a public assembly to formally complain about it, like a protest meeting about the mail.
And that tells you everything you need to know about how much this mattered to people. This wasn't some abstract government function. This is your lifeline.
For the Mormons, specifically, it was even more charged. Remember, many of these members are converts from England, from Scandinavia, maybe from the Eastern states. They have left behind families, sometimes, many times, forever. Their families are usually not super jazzed about their beloved Emmeline wandering off into the great unknown with the weirdo Mormons. They're not about to just come out here and visit. The mail isn't just news. It's the thread that keeps these people tethered to their former lives. On top of that, Brigham Young obviously is running a massive immigration operation. He needs communication from here, from Europe, all over the place. He needs to coordinate, and he needs to know what's going on in Washington.
Within a month of arriving in the Valley of 1847, just 1 month, Brigham's already calling the central gathering place Great Salt Lake City and designating a site for something he calls the Great Basin Post Office. He hasn't even gotten the city laid out, and he's already thinking about mail.
Which makes sense when you think about what he's trying to do. He's trying to build an independent people, a Zion society. One that could use their own centralized alphabet. More on that soon. And you cannot build that if you're dependent on hostile outsiders controlling your information. So let's talk about what Brigham Young actually tried to do, because this is the part of the story that most people, even people who know the Pony Express, don't know. And it's pretty extraordinary.
Does it involve the YX Company?
Officially titled the Brigham Young Express and Carrying Company. Historian Leonard Arrington called it, and let's read this because it's a pretty striking claim. Quote, "The largest single venture yet tackled by the Mormons in the Great Basin. A bold and well-conceived enterprise, which if war had not been its outcome, would undoubtedly have changed the whole structure of Mormon and perhaps Western economic development."
That's a pretty big statement.
Now, whether or not it would have played out is a tougher one. Stuff like that usually depended on volume to make it work. How many people could Brigham realistically have drafted onto team freight? Anyway, here's what happens. By 1856, Brigham Young and other territorial leaders have gathered to propose an express line, an actual express line from the Missouri River to the Pacific Coast. Remember, this is 3 years before the Pony Express. This is 3 years before Russell's, Majors, and Waddell, any of these guys.
And Young is simultaneously governor of the Utah Territory, president of the church, and superintendent of Indian affairs. Because in Mormonism, you don't just wear one hat, you wear approximately 11 hats.
Brigham would like a 12th hat, likely made out of beaver, perhaps a bowler, a derby.
You know what? There's jokes that we cannot make here.
Who's to know? This new shiny hat is head of the Express and Carrying Company. So he sends Hiram Kimball, who is his undeclared agent and married to famous OG Relief Society leader Sarah Granger Kimball, for what it's worth. He sends Kimball to submit a bid for the mail contract. And here's where it gets cheeky.
Oh, it's always cheeky with Brigham Young.
Mr. Kimball here will submit a bid of $23,000, half of what McGraw, the incumbent contractor, had proposed. Half. And the post office department, not surprisingly, awards it to the church's company, which means Brigham Young is now simultaneously territorial governor, church president, superintendent of Indian affairs, and holder of the federal mail contract.
Which, if you're a federal official in Washington, you're reading that list and your eye is twitching.
Deeply twitching. Remember, the Utah War is barely cool. And Young knows this. He's not naive. So he keeps his own name largely out of it and calls it the YX Company, a nice opaque abbreviation. It's about as sneaky as spelling 50 in Council of 50 backward. No one will ever figure that out. He lets Hiram Kimball be the public face. But everyone who matters knows it's Brigham's operation.
And the ambitions of this company are pretty impressive in the Brigham must colonize everything sort of way. It's not just about carrying mail. Young had a four-part vision. He's like a modern-day Jeff Bezos, except his yacht is a shitty steamer he takes out on the Great Salt Lake.
Right. So Brigham wants a swift pony express that will carry mail in less than 20 days in any season. And that is definitely revolutionary for 1857. You've got stagecoaches to transport immigrants quickly, freight wagons, a system of way stations every 50 miles all the way across the plains, staffed and stocked with farms so that incoming immigrants, his people, the handcart companies, the wagon trains, they will all have places to rest and resupply.
And this is directly in response to the big oopsie we'll call the Willie and Martin handcart disasters of the previous year, 1856, which we've talked about a few episodes back. Over 200 people died because there was no adequate way stations, no resupply points, nothing. Young watched those people come staggering into the valley, half dead, and he was determined it would not happen again.
In all these kind of endeavors, the human cost is just baked into the institutional ambition. And it's funded in this remarkable, typical Mormon way, off the backs of the poor members of the church. Church members are asked to donate. And they do. Between February and July of 1857, church members will donate more than $100,000 worth of livestock, equipment, and supplies. In today's values, that's like $3 million.
And remember, these are not wealthy people. These are people donating quilts and socks and wagon covers worth $3.50.
John Bagley donated a $75 horse. Elizabeth Foss donated a $6 quilt. Laura Kimball donated a pair of socks for some needy driver. These are people giving the very minimum things they can possibly give to this collective project. Like everybody, they would like their stuff faster and cheaper. Just like us today, we don't stop using Amazon, even though we know it's destroying the world. But the thing is, like, they're not gonna, it's not like they're shareholders, right? It's not like they donate things and then get part of the profits or something.
I guess you just get faster mail. It's like your Prime donation forever. Yeah,
like if people today wanted to donate to UPS to get their stuff faster, it's like that might do something, but you're not going to get anything for that.
Well, Amazon never thought to exploit missionary work, so.
Which they should. Imagine if every missionary
we're not far from
just
it,
delivered three Amazon packages worldwide.
I'm sure Bezos would like to tell his drivers, hey, you know what? You're helping the world. Why don't you drive for free? Young literally called 19 missionaries in April of 1857 to serve in this company. This was a mission. This is ecclesiastically organized labor for a commercial enterprise, which again is the kind of thing that Washington found absolutely alarming then. But with Jeff Bezos, as long as you pay him very low rates,
we don't care anymore. At this point, the separation of church and commercial enterprise was at minimum blurry. At maximum, it just didn't exist.
And McGraw, who had just lost his mail contract to the church run, upstart, is pissed. And this is where we give him the villain arc of The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives, because he starts writing letters, terrible, angry, incendiary letters to President Pierce, to Congress, calling Utah, quote, a territory with no vestige of law and order. I agree with him there. Calling the Saints' ecclesiastical organization despotic, dangerous, and damnable, which I find delightful and charming, even though it is super sour grapes.
Wah, wah, McGraw didn't get his mail contract again. Mr. McGraw, however, does have friends in very high places. He's literally connected to President-elect James Buchanan. The railroad car Buchanan takes to his inauguration is furnished by McGraw's brother, Robert.
Which is a level of access that most mail contractors can only dream of. And yet, if you can't get the mail on time faster than the Mormons, can you really blame anyone?
So we've got a perfect storm building. McGraw's fury, Federal officials fleeing Utah with wild stories, Judge Drummond, our favorite judge who was flaunting his mistress in public while criticizing polygamy, resigns and claims the Mormons destroyed court papers and murdered government officials. Fun fact, do you know what WW stands for?
What?
Whiny William.
That checks.
Then the Utah legislature will send provocative memorials to Washington, essentially questioning federal authority over them.
And Secretary of Interior Jacob Thompson reads those memorials and calls them a declaration of war.
Over letters about mail contracts and legislative procedures.
This is 1857. We talked about this before. It really is letters that help incite this. Everything is accelerating towards catastrophe that year. And then in May, Buchanan does the thing. He orders 2,500-ish, depending on who's counting, soldiers to march to Utah to install a new territorial governor without telling Congress, without much evidence of actual rebellion, but he's got a really pissed off mail guy.
Did he do that, Lindsay? Did he send 2,500 soldiers? Is that just a sexy number, we all say?
You shh. It's a sexy number. If listeners need to be reminded of what we're talking about, go back and listen to the Utah War episodes again, because we talk in depth about this. One of the first things Washington does to prepare for the coming conflict is to cancel the YX mail contract. Those jerks. Guess they want their mail slow. On June 10th, 1857, they cancel it while the army is already marching. And this is the moment that crystallizes the whole conflict. Because the mail conductors, Abraham Smoot and Nicholas Grossbeck, arrive in Independence to pick up the westbound mail, and they're simply denied. And the federal government is literally refusing to let the mail go back to Utah.
This is just one of the many crazy reminders of the chaos of that time. Imagine an era when half the country's mail just gets quarantined because of the troubles out west. And Abraham Smoot's no dummy. He figures out on his way back that these heavy wagon trains he keeps passing on the trail are army supply wagons heading to replace Brigham Young. So he tells the station keepers along the way, dismantle, come home. Just like that, the YX company starts to unravel.
And the news reaches Brigham Young on July 24th, which is Pioneer Day, the anniversary of the Saints entering the Valley. He's up in Big Cottonwood Canyon for a celebration, and Abraham Smoot, Porter Rockwell, and Judson Stoddard ride up and deliver the news. The mail is canceled, the army is coming, and William Harney, a general famous for brutality, is leading it. And we've talked about all of this in other episodes.
And this was kind of an interesting question we talked about, is how much of this knowledge of the oncoming army was in the public consciousness before this point? Because that was sort of a debate between Will Bagley and like Rick Turley and company as part of the lead up to the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Will's contention was that this moment was when they learned, for example, like that Parley P. Pratt had been murdered. And Rick and company pointed out, no, they knew about this beforehand. So I thought it was. This was one of the many rabbit holes I went down during this episode, was if you took somebody a tier down from the First Presidency Quorum of the Twelve. So thanks to a friend of the podcast, I looked at Samuel Woolley's journal, and he apparently knew nothing of the army coming before this point. He had friends that went to this big party up the canyon, and when they come back and tell him what they heard, that seems to be the first he hears of it. So that was kind of an interesting thing to realize. So, I mean, we talked about that canyon party. Can you imagine that moment? You're celebrating 10 years of surviving in the desert, and then these three guys come in breathless with the news to Silver Lake. There had been some rumors floating around, but remember again, in this era, info travels slow, it's muddled. These guys have firsthand reports. They've seen the wagons slowly making their way to Utah. Again, go back, listen to those Utah War episodes, because that very much plays into how all of this mail contract stuff will play out.
And like Brian mentioned, the fact that Mormons had built this way station doesn't just become a convenient thing for Mormon travelers to avoid the handcart disaster. It's an information and control line. And so Mormons can control information coming west, right? Unless it's going around Cape Horn, they've got an in there. So I can see why the debate was robust, because Mormons controlled and dominated the travel lines, the supply lines. Anyway, you know the drill with the Utah War. Within weeks, Brigham Young has declared martial law, he's activated the Nauvoo Legion, and authorized the burning of Fort Bridger and Fort Supply, as seen in American Primeval, the very way stations the Saints had spent millions building.
Lot Smith burns three contractor wagon trains, his men rot off hundreds of federal cattle, the army gets stranded in Wyoming through the winter, and the YX company, which could have, would have, should have changed everything, just kind of evaporates.
Arrington estimates the total cost of to the church at about $200,000, which is about $6 million today. It's gone. And when peace comes, John Hockaday, the brother of one of the men who wrote the poisonous letters to Pierce, gets the mail contract, now worth $190,000.
It's a bitter, bitter pill. Or is it a seed for better things to come?
It definitely was a seed, because Hockaday stations, built with federal money on the ruins of what Young had built, becomes the skeleton of the Pony Express.
The Mormons built the road, and then someone else got to run it.
Mormons walked so the ponies could run?
Something like that. All of this is not going to help the Mormon persecution complex.
Okay, so now we're 1859, 1860. The Utah War has ended in an embarrassing anticlimax. Camp Floyd is established 40 miles south of Salt Lake City, the largest military post in America, aimed at the Mormons. And William H. Russell is sitting in his office at the freighting firm of Russell, Majors, and Waddell, staring directly at the problem.
Russell, Majors, and Waddell. These three guys are worth pausing on for a minute, because they are the biggest freighting operation in American history at this point. At their peak, 6,000 employees, 75,000 oxen, thousands of wagons, a sawmill, a meatpacking plant, a bank, and insurance company.
I had to, like, check this. 75,000 oxen.
75,000 oxen. Those numbers are why I am less hopeful than Leonard that YX would have worked out, because I don't think even Brigham at his most whip things into shape could get this scale. Like, to get those contracts, you had to think big.
Yeah, you did. I mean, give Mormons what they got through was scrappiness. I mean, Juanita Brooks's father ran the mail. That was how she spent her early days. And I'm sure Mormons did it cheap, but they rode hard and fast for what they wanted.
Yeah, so this operation, this one is not small. They held the government contract to supply the massive army contingent during the Utah War, which, like we just described, was a financial catastrophe for them. The Nauvoo Legion burns their wagons, Lot Smith runs off their cattle. It's not great.
So Russell has lost a fortune in the Utah War. He's failed to get the War Department to reimburse him, and he has this audacious idea. High-speed mail service on the Central Route, Missouri to California, only in 10 days.
And everybody's like, that's impossible.
The established mail route was the Butterfield Overland Mail, which ran on a southern route through Texas and New Mexico and took 25 days. And the southern route has powerful congressional supporters who wanted it to stay. The central route, the route through Utah, was considered seasonal at best and suicidal at worst.
Mr. Russell is going to prove him wrong. He spends approximately $100,000 in 2 months over the winter of 1860 to stand up 190 stations, 400 horses, and 80 riders along nearly 2,000 miles of trail.
And here's the thing people don't always appreciate. He is largely building on infrastructure that already existed because of the Mormon settlement. So the trail through Utah was not wilderness. It was the Mormon trail. The stations in Wyoming were on or near what had been the YX Company sites. And Salt Lake City itself was built to be the central hub because it was a real city with supplies and blacksmiths and everything a mail operation needs.
And the guy they put in charge of the Utah division is Howard Egan.
Oh, Howard Egan. Let's talk about Howard Egan for a minute because he is one of my absolute favorite figures in this whole story. And I don't think he gets enough mention in Mormon history.
Oh, I'm sorry. Was Bill Hartley's extensive biography not enough for you?
It was everything I wanted.
Now, in fairness, you don't really hear a lot about Egan. He's quite the character. He's an Irish immigrant. He joins the church in Massachusetts, comes across with the initial Pioneer Company of 1847, and then helps blaze much of the original Central Overland Trail. He is, by 1860, one of the most experienced trail men in the West.
And he's appointed superintendent of the division from Salt Lake City to Roberts Creek in Nevada. So he's responsible for the section of the route that runs through the most brutal desert in North America, the Great Basins, Skull Valley, the Salt Flats, the Nevada Desert.
And on that first run, April 7th, 1860, the mail is heading westbound. It's been 9 days since it left St. Joseph, Missouri. Egan himself will ride the final stretch into Salt Lake City from Rush Valley in Tooele County. 75 miles in heavy rainstorm on muddy roads. Oh, and it was at night.
5 hours and 15 minutes.
And the Deseret News is waiting for him. They'd set up what amounted to a press pool, Pony Express Club, actually organized by Brigham Young himself, that paid for a subscription to the California Press Service. When the Express galloped in, the compositors were up all through the night setting type for an extra edition.
Brigham Young started a Pony Express fan club, and I love this detail so much. What a nerd. I'd join a fan club if Josh Brolin was still one of the young writers.
And it makes sense, because even though the Utah War had been kind of a catastrophic rupture between the Mormons and the federal government, Brigham Young understood that the telegraph and the mail were coming regardless, and the saints needed to be part of that network, not isolated from it.
And the route itself, I want to describe this for listeners because it goes through some of the most stunning and terrifying landscapes in Utah. Like from Salt Lake City heading west, you drop into Tooele County. And so you've got like the lake, and which is just otherworldly and strange to look at. And then you go through Rush Valley past what is now Point of the Mountain. And we'll come back to what's at the Point of the Mountain in a moment. And then you go into Skull Valley, which...
Skull Valley. Even that name tells you something.
I mean, it's a killer name. It's this long valley over 40 miles bounded by the Stansbury Mountains on the east and Cedar Mountain on the west. It's semi-desert. It's like 4,000 feet in elevation. It's ugly, desolate area. And the Pony Express route crossed the south end of it using the lowest passes to get through. And in 1860s, you've got Howard Egan's son building and maintaining stations in places like Lookout Pass, which they called General Johnson's Pass in the Pony Express days, and Simpson Springs.
Simpson Springs is worth describing for just a minute. Captain James Simpson, who blazed the route in 1859 while he's looking for the Central Overland Mail Route, first named it Pleasant Spring because the water there is so good. And in that desert, good water is everything. Talk to your local Donner Party folks. It was the most dependable water supply on that stretch of the trail.
It's still out there. You can go drive out there. It's like literally in the middle of nowhere. It's crazy. And the first eastbound Pony Express rider stopped there at 5 p.m. on April 7th, 1860. The westbound rider at 2 a.m. on April 10th. And those times were noted and recorded because this was a military precision operation.
The schedule obviously is everything. They've made promises. And that's not something, I don't know, as modern folks, we can fully appreciate. These dudes are going 75 to 100 miles a day, changing horses every 10 to 15 miles at relay stations, and swapping a special mail pouch called a mochila, from the Spanish word for pouch or backpack, from one horse to the next in 2 minutes or less.
The mochila is a wonderful piece of engineering. It's a leather covering that goes over your saddle with the horn and cantle projecting through these specially cut holes. So 4 padlocked cantinas, these little hard leather boxes in the corners, they could hold 20 pounds of mail. And when a rider came into a station, he didn't unsaddle his horse. He just slid the mochila off and threw it onto the fresh horse. 2 minutes and he's gone.
The employer said the mochila must get through, even if the horse and rider don't.
Which is a remarkable thing to say to a teenager earning $100 a month. And many of these riders were teenagers. I mentioned this before, the show The Young Riders first captured my attention when I was a kid. It was a show about teenagers. Josh Brolin stars in it. He had a big crush on him. Most kids these days from these parts get jobs at Swig and Chick-fil-A. But back then, you rode a horse and disappeared in Skull Valley forever.
I mean, if you're going to give someone the message that that thing's got to get through even if you don't, a teenager's not a terrible choice. They're not going to care, honestly, that much. And some of these riders are extraordinary. You've got Elijah Nick Wilson from Grantsville, Utah, nearly killed by an arrow to the head near Spring Valley Station in Nevada. You've got Pony Bob Haslam, who made the longest ride on record, 380 miles round trip on a horse, while wounded, carrying the mail that contained Lincoln's inaugural address. On this record-breaking ride, when he reached Cold Spring Station, heading back westbound, he found the Indians had raided the place, killing the station keeper and running off all the stock. He was shot through the jaw with an arrow, losing 3 teeth, but still completed the ride.
And you've got the Egan sons, Howard Ranson Egan and Richard Erastus Egan, who were Howard Sr.'s boys, riding for the Express. A family business in the most extreme possible sense.
The pay for these guys is pretty good, $100 to $125 a month, when unskilled laborers are making less than a dollar a day. But the conditions were, I mean, we've got this account recorded by Howard Egan of a rider heading west, arriving at Simpson Springs to find there'd been a massive flood that had torn out the road through the riverbed. The rider on the previous trip had heard what he thought was heavy wind, so he put spurs to his pony. He just barely makes it across before a wall of water 15 feet high, full of brush and debris, comes roaring down the canyon.
Now picture that, but Josh Brolin. What they did, they just kept going. The mail went through no matter what.
Almost always. Only once in the entire 18-month run did service genuinely stop during the Paiute War in May and June of 1860. The Paiutes in Nevada had suffered a devastating winter, and by spring, they're at war.
In May of 1860, the Pony Express was forced to suspend service entirely for nearly a month, the only time in its entire run that mail genuinely stopped. And the cause was what historians like Brian just mentioned was called the Paiute War. So the northern Paiutes in Nevada had just survived this devastating winter, brutal blizzards, widespread starvation, and this tribe is pushed to the edge. And their chief, Numaga, fasted for 3 days and pleaded for peace. But war came anyway, sparked at Williams Station, a Pony Express relay on the Carson River, where accounts differ significantly on what happened. One version says it was
a white indigenous encounter? The accounts differ?
We don't say. Okay, so one version says it was a deliberate Paiute provocation. The other says the men at the station had kidnapped 2 Paiute women and the raiders came to investigate and free them. And that second version matters because If true, the attack that, quote, disrupted the Pony Express was actually just a rescue mission. 7 more stations were attacked, 16 employees killed, roughly 150 horses stolen or run off. U.S. troops ended the uprising by June, and the Pony Express company tallied the cost at $75,000, and the Paiutes tallied theirs in ways that never made it into the ledger books.
And here's a detail that's kind of haunting. One of the mail pouches, the Mochila, that left San Francisco on July 21st, 1860, didn't make its destination on time or even close to on time. It was recovered and finally delivered to New York almost 2 years later.
2 years later, someone's little letter sitting in Mochila somewhere in Nevada telling them that daddy's died of diphtheria and you have to wait a few years to get it.
He shunned me, Alice Angel fell. Doesn't want me in heaven.
All right, Lindsay, we got to talk about Porter Rockwell, too.
I feel like we've been talking about Porter Rockwell around the edges of this entire episode, so I'm finally, we're just going to address it directly, because he is, and I say this as someone who has spent years studying complicated Mormon historical figures, Porter Rockwell is one of the most genuinely fascinating, genuinely terrifying, genuinely complicated human figures in all of 19th century Utah history.
So let's start with who he was. Orrin Porter Rockwell, born in 1813 in Massachusetts, and his family becomes neighbors with the Smith family in New York when Joseph is a teenager. So you picture, he's like 8 years younger than Joseph. Porter grows up essentially alongside the founding of Mormonism and is a childhood friend of Joseph Smith's.
Which means he's in it at the absolute beginning. He's baptized in 1830, the year the church is organized. He is not a convert who comes to Mormonism as an adult seeking something. He grows up inside of it, and it's the waters that he swims in.
And Porter, from the start, he's a guy you call on when you need something done that can't be done gently, diplomatically. He's a Danite in Missouri. That's that Mormon protection organization that's formed in response to the violence that's all around the Mormons. He serves as bodyguard for Joseph Smith. He's with the church through every persecution, every forced migration, and Mike Quinn believes he might have been in love with Joseph Smith.
Honestly, I spent some time thinking about this, and I'm with Mike Quinn. We don't ever hear stories of Porter carousing with other men like some of the other Danites were, and we know that Porter has 3 wives. He was never a polygamist because he only had one wife at a time. I don't think women were his vice. I think violence was, though, and then there's that gosh darn prophecy. Joseph Smith apocryphally tells Porter that as long as he never cuts his hair, no bullet will take his life. Very biblical. And Porter famously never cuts his hair for a while, but by the time he's a middle-aged man in Utah, he looks like a biblical figure. He's got this long flowing hair and beard, and photographs of him are striking. He looks like he belongs in a different century.
Or did he cut his hair? Quick tangent. There's a really interesting story told many years later by a woman named Elizabeth Roundy. She tells how Rockwell was in California and ran into potato-based podcast friends alert, Agnes Coolbrith, whose first husband was Don Carlos Smith, younger brother of Joseph and Hiram. In this account, Agnes has been battling typhoid fever and lost all of her hair. Rockwell didn't really have any money to help her out, so he cut off enough of his hair that she could have a wig. And Roundy tells this story in the context of that prophecy and concludes, quote, "From that time, he said that he could not control the desire for strong drink nor the habit of swearing." Wouldn't be a Mormon story if we skipped a chance to moralize.
When I shave, I can't help swearing too, to be honest.
Damn it. Yeah. Why? A haircut? Haircuts make me swear more than just about anything. But what's interesting, Roundy is a British convert. She doesn't even arrive in the States until after this story would have happened, if it did, so you can do with it what you will. There you go. There's another Porter story for the archive. And all of this folklore around the prophecy becomes part of the Porter Rockwell legend, because he is involved in an almost uncountable number of violent incidents over his lifetime, and he survives all of them. I mean, in fairness, he starts most of them, but he's shot at, he's ambushed, he's pursued, until he dies in 1878 at 65 years old of heart failure.
Now, it's important to know that everything Porter does becomes legend. He never cuts his hair, or maybe he does, and it becomes legend. you know, he had a dog that rode on the back of his saddle that would lick his face when he was going to kill. That was one of the legends about him at the time.
He rode around naked on a unicycle and made Eliza Snow giggle.
Hold on, we got
to... Or so Richard Dutcher would troll us.
I got to tell that story because I do think Richard Dutcher, God bless him for being such a good storyteller, has ruined Mormon history because people have quoted that to me as a historical thing. He started a very bad rumor. Richard Dutcher, filmmaker, funny guy, would write these like fake historical stories
with sources fake sources,
and it looked so good, and like he wrote it so well, and so he writes a story, we were all like, that's an incredible story. It's about Eliza R. Snow, one of the sources from her journal, she writes finding Porter Rockwell drunk and riding a unicycle naked on the temple block, and I really wanted that story to be real.
Yeah, apparently so did a lot of other people.
It's not, though. And if you hear it, you got to know that that's a Richard Dutcher branded rumor. Anyway, whether you attribute any of this to divine protection or extraordinary luck and skill, he was a remarkable frontier character.
And we got to be honest here. He's not a simple hero. In fact, outside of Mormon memory, he's not a hero at all. He's a bad guy. He's a cold-blooded murderer.
I have to talk to you about this too, because I think our culture especially has grown up seeing him as a hero so much. I mean, have you seen the statue in Provo?
And we kind of love, there's roads named after him.
Looks like the Little Mermaid, like cowboy, like it's crazy. But I remember Joe Geisner telling me, like, Lindsay, he murdered children. Like, he's not a good guy. Okay, continue.
Yeah, and this is fun because, you know, you get all Porter Rockwell, blah, 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 and Howard Egan gets off easy. He's a colorful character. Rockwell's a killer. See, we've got some mountain common law erasure going on.
Told you, Howard Egan doesn't get his due.
All right, back to Rockwell. So the evidence for his involvement in extrajudicial killings during the Utah War period is, let's say, substantial. Bill McKinnon's research on Utah war violence, which we've been drawing on today, documents this pattern of sanctioned lawlessness in territorial Utah that Porter is very much at the heart of.
There's the Aiken Party murders, six Californians who wander into Utah at the wrong place, wrong time in October of 1857. They're arrested on suspicion of being army spies, released, and four of them are then murdered on the Sevier River while being escorted, we'll call it, south by Porter Rockwell and others, and their cash weapons, horses, and silver-studded saddles just get scooped up by the Mormons. How convenient.
Rockwell is actually indicted for those murders in 1877. He's awaiting trial for it when he dies in 1878.
He also said famously that he, quote, never killed a man who didn't need killing, which is a quote that tells you a lot about how he understood his role. He saw himself as executing justice in a place where justice was otherwise unavailable or biased against his people.
And there's a way in which that's not entirely wrong. If you think about the long arc of Mormon history, they'd been exterminated from Missouri by government order from the governor. Prophet had been murdered in a jail. Federal judges in Utah are corrupt, absent, sometimes openly hostile. That's complicated. We know that. But the formal justice system is not really available to them in any meaningful sense.
And this doesn't justify everything. It does contextualize it. He's a Wild West maniac. It's why his contemporaries, at least on those on his side, revered him. He was definitely feared. Kids would like whisper about him. He had, as you say, a reputation.
He's an interesting guy because on the one hand, the knee-jerk reaction is to picture him like the Biff Tannen ancestor in Back to the Future 3. Like this, you know, spit and gravel. But I feel like we've heard like he had kind of a high, lispy voice. Like it was wild to hear Mark Hoffman's voice in the documentary. That's kind of how I picture it being described. Like it seems like he would have been quite the person to run into.
Here's the thing. Being responsible with history, Mike Quinn never came out and said, at least to me, that he thought Porter Rockwell was gay. But he said it in that he thought that he loved Joseph. And I started reading the history through that lens. And when you do, it is interesting to think about. Again, this is a man who ran with guys who liked, you know, Hickman, who was running a brothel in winter quarters out of his wagon box. Porter Rockwell's not doing that. He has a discipline. And so I wonder if, you know, in thinking about why does he kill? What if it's, you know, his romance with Joseph Smith? What if violence is his poetry?
That's part of it. I mean, you have Hosea Stout is a contemporary. I think there's a lot of overlap. These are guys who are just hardwired to be zealous for something. It's going
to
be something.
They just like to kill.
Here I go killing again. I think these are guys who are just, they're going to be zealous for something. It just happened to be Mormonism and Porter, specifically Joseph Smith. So
I will say, I think this is worth mentioning. If you still think Porter Rockwell is a good guy or a hero to emulate, we were taking a tour of Mountain Meadows with Barbara Jones Brown. We had some Mormon fundamentalists there who were kids. They were teenage boys. And I remember her telling the most brutal part of the massacre about murdering people at, you know, point blank range. And one of the kids goes, "Cool." And I was like,
No, this is not
a video game, you guys. Like, this is a real thing. And I think Mormons look at Porter Rockwell like some video game hero, not as someone who, like, dragged a teenager shot and hung from his horse back to his mother and dropped her on her front lawn. You know, like, this is not a nice person.
That's probably the worst fruits of the persecution complex, is that you look for someone who rights those scales a little bit, right?
Yeah. And I get it. Like, I romanticize the West in the same way, right? I think we're guilty of it, especially those of us who grew up in the West and we have ancestors. We had an incentive to do so.
It's these filmmakers. They're always to blame.
Just always to blame. Beloved pioneers. Well, that's what I would say. Just like, check when you hear these stories and these legends, remember that, like, the legend is the fun. It's like Pirates of the Caribbean, like Johnny Depp. But would you want to hang out with real actual pirates? Probably not.
And not to mention, as a descendant of someone who was killed at Hans Mill, I know how much Mormons love to trot that story.
There you go, bringing your Hans Mill card again.
It's the other side of the coin. It's like, you can't be all up in arms about Hans Mill all the time if Porter Rockwell is this, you know, gosh darn it, he just killer. Can't not yeah. kill people. Yeah, it's the same kind of deal here.
Well, I was having this conversation recently with someone who, like, loved Porter Rockwell, and I was like, "Why do you think he killed?" And he was like, "I think he didn't want to. It was like, he struggled." And I was like, "A reluctant killer? I don't think, like, if you read about how he killed, I don't think so." However,
it's a great storyline.
It's a great storyline, but, like, here's how outsiders see it. They see it like, imagine someone killing for, like, Warren Jeffs. I hate to bring, like, that's how they see it. Like, the cause is not just to them. They're like, that guy is a psychopath, murder, like, a cult murderer guy. That's how they see Porter Rockwell.
He's protecting the weirdness. That's not going to be seen well.
But the Little Mermaid statue in Provo of him is pretty, pretty lovely. His hair is very curly. Curly girl, Porter Rockwell.
All right, we got to bring this train back on the tracks, because this is where our boy Porter Rockwell intersects with the story today. Because he's not just a bodyguard and enforcer, he's a businessman. He's a frontiersman, he's a cattleman. In 1856, he found something remarkable at a place called Point of the Mountain. So if you're driving south through the center of Utah, it's Bluffdale, Utah, basically today. It's at the point where the Salt Lake Valley narrows before it opens back up into Utah Valley.
And what he builds there is a hotel, a hot springs resort. The hot springs at the location were famous, and he builds a brewery. Yes, Mormons drink, and it was one of the earliest breweries in Utah.
And that's not too surprising, because he had run a tavern in Nauvoo, much to Emma's chagrin, so it's kind of a natural extension. As one of the first commercial breweries in Utah, it was slinging 500 gallons of suds a day at its peak.
And this is Orrin Porter Rockwell, the man the church called its destroying angel, well, or people called the destroying angel, running a brewery. And the theological implications of that are something we aren't going to fully unpack right now, but we've talked about it. Mormons did drink, and they made their own beer.
And Rockwell is nothing if not entrepreneurial, but more importantly for our story, the Hot Springs Hotel and Brewery becomes a contract Pony Express station, station number 10 on the Utah route. It's 10 miles south of the Trader's Rest station.
So riders coming south out of Salt Lake City along what is now State Street would swing through Porter Rockwell's brewery hotel. They would change their horses and maybe grab a bite to eat.
If they didn't have a sandwich named a Rockwell Reuben or a Porter Patty Melt, like, what are they even doing? Come on.
Porter Patty, come on now.
So there's a version of history where this hotel, it's a very pleasant stop. The hot springs are legitimately therapeutic. The hotel is apparently comfortable by frontier standards. And of course, the beer is plentiful.
Mark Twain stopped at one of the stations along the stretch, and he and his brother Orion were traveling overland in 1861. And Twain's account of the whole experience is infamous, characteristically irreverent and funny. He describes the riders as, quote, usually a little bit of man, small, wiry, and lightweight.
They had to be. These guys couldn't weigh more than 125 pounds, including their gear, because obviously you're trying to put as little weight on the horse as possible. You're trying to go fast.
And then there's the story at Riverbed Station west of Simpson Springs in the desert, where a lone woman passenger on a stagecoach woke up to find the horses standing still and the driver gone. She drove the coach herself to Simpson Springs, where Porter Rockwell was waiting, looked at her gun, found one empty shell, listened to her story, and then he went to investigate himself.
And he finds the driver's body about a mile west of the station, shot through the heart with an arrow. And Porter being Porter, drove to the nearest well and dumped the body down it because it was too hot to haul a dead man across the desert.
When the stagecoach company sent people demanding he go retrieve the body, he told them he'd be happy to lower them down the well to investigate on their own. But nobody took him up on it.
That's surprising, honestly. I can't imagine why. So earlier in the story, during the Utah War, remember Rockwell is managing the Fort Laramie to Salt Lake City stretch of the YX Melt Route. He's out there on the trail during the worst of it. Remember, he's one of those guys also who rides into Big Cottonwood Canyon on July 24th to deliver the news that the Army is coming.
What a beloved pioneer hero saving the day. Oh, wait, he's also the man General Connor goes to when he needs a guide for the Bear River campaign in January 1863 to massacre all the Shoshone people in one of the most horrific episodes in Utah history.
And that's another dimension of Rockwell that you can't just ignore, because he participates in the infrastructure of the federal military presence in Utah, even as he's simultaneously deeply loyal to the church and its leadership. He operates in the moral gray zones of the frontier with pretty remarkable ease.
He also established a ranch in School Valley in the southeast end at Sheep Rock Mountain in 1863, just a few years after the Pony Express ran through the valley. And earlier, he established his ranch at Government Creek Station on the Pony Express route, 10 miles or so west of Lookout Pass.
So he's right there, homesteading along the Pony Express Trail, integrating his private enterprise with the infrastructure of Western communication.
He's a complicated man. I have so many feelings on him, mostly because, you know, in film consulting, you don't know this, but some of the most infamous characters in like John Wayne films are based on him. Big Jake is one. The guy with the machete is based on Porter Rockwell. So yeah, he deserves his own episode someday. Multiple episodes probably, but definitely not the statues in Lehi that portray him as a heroic angel with flowing hair.
So he's kind of the human embodiment of what the entire Mormon male freighting story is. It's frontier pragmatism, it's religious devotion, it's political violence, it's entrepreneurial hustle, all tangled together. Oh, and then murders, plenty of murders.
Don't matter if the poem blows, I'm gonna wind up working in the thick of it. Sunshine through the rain and snow, there's an oily brine bilge water baptism.
So let's pull back for a minute and look at the bigger picture for just a sec, because I think the Pony Express, as spectacular as it is, I mean, this is interesting, as I was working on these episodes, one of my kids noticed, and he's like, oh yeah, I heard about this. Yeah, it's a pretty enduring icon of the West, the Pony Express, but that kind of iconic image actually can obscure the larger story, which is about freighting.
Yeah, the Pony Express is sort of the romantic version of the story. The hero on horseback, the Mochila, 10-day miracle. But the freight wagons are where the real economic power was.
Russell, Majors, and Waddell at their peak are moving millions of pounds of material across the plains every year. In an era where you have the descendant of the postal system, you have UPS, you have FedEx, you have DHL, we have zillions of options in the modern world. You don't have that at this point. You have whatever the current guy or guys in this case can do. And these guys are doing it. 75,000 oxen, remember. They've got the Army contract, which is 3 million pounds of material. That's not heroic and romantic as much as it is industrial. That's that large scale we were talking about earlier. That's what's going to make this profitable.
And the Mormons understand the freighting economy really well, because they'd been dependent on it in some of the most vulnerable ways possible, dependent on the Gentile freighters to bring their people and their goods across the plains. And those freighters were really expensive, they were unreliable, and sometimes really actively hostile to the Mormons.
These are the excessive charges that Brigham Young liked to complain about. He, as always, did not want Mormon money going to ostentatious, proud, and Epicurean Gentiles. I guarantee you somebody told him the word Epicurean. There's no way that dude knew that word. He wanted LDS saints freighting for Latter-day Saints. We're going to keep that Mormon money in-house.
And the YX company, had it survived, would have been exactly that. Freight at 12.5 cents per pound, controlled by the church, staffed by missionaries, serving the saints.
What actually happens after the Utah War is the freighting economy of the West becomes dominated by a different set of characters, because Russell Majors and Waddell actually go bankrupt. The Pony Express, despite all the romance, all the memories, loses $200,000. It grossed $90,000 and spent $290,000.
Oh, the Gentiles, never profitable for a single month.
Never profitable, which is not surprising. You're sending a single skinny little dude with a mochila. That means you can only carry so much stuff. This is the predecessor of some crazy drone delivery idea. And the man who swoops in and buys up the broken shards of the Pony Express and these earlier freighters is Ben Holiday, the Stagecoach King. So he acquires the Russell, Majors, and Waddell stations, the routes, eventually the remnants of the Butterfield line. He runs the whole Central Overland operation.
And then in 1866, Holiday sells everything to... Wait, I hear something.
The Wells Fargo wagon! The Wells Fargo wagon!
Oh, the Wells Fargo wagon is a coming down the
Wells
street.
Wells Fargo wagon is
oh,
a
the Wells Fargo.
Coming down the street. Wells Fargo buys it all for $1.5 million, and Wells Fargo uses the Pony Express logo for its brand, for its guard and armored car services for decades.
So the Pony Express, which ran for only 18 months and was not even close to profitable, becomes one of the most enduring images in American commercial history. That's kind of an interesting idea. Wells Fargo, a company that mostly foreclosed on farmers, gets to wrap itself in that legend. Oh well, they did send a cannon for the courthouse square.
That is a very American story, but here's what I keep coming back to. The Transcontinental Telegraph, which is what actually kills the Pony Express, connected on October 24th, 1861, and it was connected in Salt Lake City. Of all the places in the West, the wire came together at the crossroads of the Mormon kingdom.
It's kind of interesting. I don't know for how long it was, but the music and the spoken word were coming to you from the crossroads of the West. That's actually quite accurate several ways. And Brigham Young's very first telegram on that telegraph line, delivered after the outbreak of the Civil War, when people are kind of curious, what's Utah going to do, is this. Quote, Utah has not seceded, but is firm for the Constitution and laws of our once happy country, and is warmly interested in such useful enterprises as the one so far completed.
The one so far completed. The man had just watched his own communication empire get dismantled, watched the army march through a city, watched the very infrastructure he built get burned and sold and absorbed by federal investments, and his first telegram is gracious, politically shrewd, and a little bit sly.
It will not prevent him and others from crapping on the Union, Abraham Lincoln, lots of things.
But he's not bitter.
But he does say once happy country, and you know, that's not nothing.
That's absolutely not nothing for him because, you know, our guy, he's always reading the room.
And he's right that Salt Lake City was, as Benjamin Ferris, the Secretary of Utah Territory, had called it, quote, the halfway house between the eastern and western portions of the continent. The geography alone was always going to make it a hub.
Young just wanted to control what flowed through the hub, and he almost did for a brief, remarkable moment in 1857. The man held the mail contract. The transportation infrastructure, the territorial governorship, and the allegiance of thousands of people willing to donate their quilts and their horses for a good cause.
I can't believe you didn't mention the socks. This is sock erasure.
Well, he held the socks, too. I'm sure he did.
And then... it's all taken away. By bad luck, by political enemies, the Mountain Meadows Massacre, which cast its shadow over all of this, and by the sheer grinding force of federal power.
You know, in the Mountain Meadows Massacre, that's what I always say. Bad luck. Bad luck. Arrington's estimate, $15 million in total cost to the federal government from the Utah War, $452 million in today's dollars, to, quote, force conformity of social viewpoint and political submission. That's what he called it.
And what did they get for it? Camp Floyd is deactivated in 1861. Albert Sidney Johnston, who famously never met Brigham Young face-to-face, they're just 40 miles apart, goes off and dies at the Battle of Shiloh. As a general, he's actually the highest-ranking officer killed in the Civil War.
You know, the irony always gets to me on this, that Albert Sidney Johnston, the man sent to crush the Utah Mormon Rebellion, whose name we, you know, were taught to fear in primary, dies 4 years later fighting for the Confederacy.
Meanwhile, Salt Lake City just keeps on keeping on, being the crossroads of the West.
Now, I want to close with a special spiritual thought, because I think this history teaches us, because it's genuinely important because of the fun details and the fascinating characters, but I would like a spiritual thought.
I will allow it.
Okay, so there's a version of this story, the popular version, that's just about heroic riders and fast horses and American individualism and the romance of the frontier, and that is the show I like to watch with Josh Brolin as a teen. And that story's not wrong. These were heroic riders. That was a huge feat. Nick Wilson with an arrow in his head, Pony Bob Haslam riding 380 miles wounded, Howard Egan on a muddy night covered 75 miles in 5 hours.
Yeah, those are real acts of physical courage. I'm not doing that. I don't want to diminish those guys.
And neither do I, but when you look at the full picture, when you see the YX company and the political machinery around it, when you see how mail contracts were used as weapons in the Utah War, when you see how Brigham Young understood from the beginning that communication was sovereignty, you realize that this is just a story about power. And it's actually really, really relevant now when you think about how much money and power is in information, right? In AI, we're having these discussions now. That's what this is. It's not just a story about mail. This is about who gets to control the flow of information and about who decides what kind of civilization gets built in the American West.
And the Mormons make a serious, sophisticated, well-funded bid to control that flow. And, you know, they might have come close.
They built the road, they staffed it, they burned it when they had to, and then they watched someone else come and run it. And then Brigham Young, ever the gracious man, sent that telegram.
Utah has not seceded.
Utah has not seceded.
Gracious. Imagine an alternate universe. What if Utah does secede?
That's so interesting. I mean, it would have been a good time, right? They didn't really have the resources. And yet Brigham Young performs loyalty. And there are reasons why he does this, right? Which we're going to get into the statehood discussion. But really, like, he's a little wounded. He's just gone through the Utah War, but he knows what he's doing, completely in the command of the language.
The Pony Express, again, just 18 months, loses a crap load of money. It's on the logo of one of the biggest banks in America. It's a National Historic Trail. It's commemorated with stamps and statues. It's something like your kids actually know about. And, not to undersell it, a 100-mile ultramarathon through Skull Valley.
I think that's crazy that there's a 100-mile ultramarathon on the rocks. It's crazy out there. But I feel like that is the correct way to honor these riders.
Yeah, truly. If you want to understand what it's like, go sign up for that. You can put me down for the last 3 miles. I'll be there.
The history that doesn't make it into the romance is the Goshute people, whose lands are the trails that they cross. They are out in Skull Valley. The Paiute people, whose resistance briefly stopped the express, and the indigenous communities whose sacred valley, Skull Valley, got named for their bones and who were cleared away to make room for this American project.
The way that stations are built on land, nobody bothered to acquire the legal title to. The violence authored by men on both sides who convinced themselves they were doing the right thing, they're acting righteously.
The 120-ish people murdered at Mountain Meadows Massacre in the shadow of all of this.
Yeah, all of that together, you can't tell the story as pure triumph. It just wasn't.
But it's an extraordinary tale. The paradox of the West, the ambition of it, the scale, the speed, the fact that for 18 months, a horse and a teenage rider could carry a letter from Missouri to California in 10 days across the desert, over mountains, through Indian country in winter. It's remarkable. That existed at all is all remarkable.
And the Mormons are pretty central to this, as builders, as writers, as station keepers, as the political context that shaped this whole enterprise. That's a story that a lot of people don't know. It's a story that deserves to be told more fully.
which is what we're here for. So if today's episode moved you, challenged you, or made you want to sign up for a 100-mile ultra marathon through School Valley, which to be clear, I am not doing, consider supporting us at the Sunstone Education Foundation, which makes this work possible. You can find us at sunstone.org, and we've opened our registration for our new symposium. So get on there and help us out a little.
Until next time, friends, the mail and the mochila must go through, even if the podcasters do not. Hush now, child, and don't you cry. Your folks might understand you by and by. Just move on up towards the Books of Mormons report, powered by Benchmark Books. Linz, is there ever a bad time to pitch Bill McKinnon's books to folks?
Of course not.
All right, good. Let's do it again. His two-volume treatment of the Utah War at Swords Point, part of the Kingdom in the West series, it's fantastic, really. Anytime anything from this time period comes up, that is one of the first places I turn. And if you need to scratch your Porter Rockwell itch, Hal Schindler's bio, Orrin Porter Rockwell, Man of God, Son of Thunder, from our friends at the University of Utah Press, also excellent. Bill Hartley's Faithful and Fearless, Major Howard Egan, Early Mormonism, and the Pioneering of the American West is both very comprehensive, and it's on sale. Another friend of the podcast, Evan Jensen, wrote an excellent chapter, The Mail, the Trail, and the War, The Brigham Young Express and Carrying Company, that's in Business and Religion, The Intersection of Faith and Finance. As always, you can get these and everything else in the Mormon universe at Benchmark Books. Visit Benchmark in Salt Lake or at benchmarkbooks.com.
As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.